Please silence all electronic devices.
Members, the nurse of the day today is...
The job we have as legislators is to decide where the lines are.
It is a very sacred and holy institution.
I'll move to amend the bill. Even the old folks
in Devon knew. He said, hey, ain't you Jesse Harris? And I couldn't deny that. I said, yeah.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
While I do not believe I did anything illegal or ever thought I was doing anything illegal...
You're fired.
North Carolina General Assembly Act.
Any further discussion or debate?
This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. Coattail riding has begun as candidates for statewide races fully embrace the presidential candidates. And a social media gaffe highlights the growing role of non-traditional campaigning. I'm Dave DeWitt, Managing Editor for News at WUNC, and I'm here with Jeff Tiberi, Capitol Bureau Chief. Hi, Jeff.
Hey there.
It's been 2 weeks of national conventions. Donald Trump saw a national poll bump coming out of the GOP convention last week. And as we're recording this, Hillary Clinton will speak tonight at the DNC. And we don't know yet if the polls will be kind to her. The bigger question is, did these conventions change anyone's mind here in North Carolina? Jeff, what is your take on that?
Sure, they changed some people's minds. But how many? And how important is this? And how many of those people's minds will be changed again in the next 100 to 105 days?
Right, because we're way far away from Election Day. The conventions are earlier this year than normal. And the question is whose minds are going to get changed then. But also now, I mean, we talked last week about suburban voters. It really is about suburban voters. And if you looked at those two conventions, one was built on fear.
Right.
One was built on what? What was the Democratic convention built on, do you think? Hope or... There's more positive energy for sure.
I would use the word unity. I think that they are at a point of unity toward the end of the week. Unity and legacy, right? I mean, it's as much about the last 8 years and moving it forward from the Democratic perspective as it is anything else. I think we heard that with President Obama's speech last night, to some extent.
Right.
I don't know if there's one thing or one word to coalesce around, but I think that is some of it. Before I forget... I was going to mention this later, but you triggered it, and I'll forget if I don't mention it now. It is early. It is more than 3 months until this thing ends. I will propose to you, and you can chew on this. You can dump it in the trash immediately. You can respond or not respond to it now. At some point in the next 3 months, we ought to spend a week and do no political coverage.
Like as a station or
as a station,
all of media.
We should cover every NPR national political story up for a week. I know that's never going to fly, but wouldn't that be nice to like get a little break from this whole thing?
I think a lot of people would appreciate that.
Yeah,
even if
I wonder how many.
Wouldn't.
I wonder if we get a poll on that.
Yeah,
I'm not going to. I think unity is what the Democrats were striving for, particularly after how this thing started in Philadelphia. And to be fair, last week on the podcast, I called the Republican National Convention a dumpster fire. And the beginning of this one, this was a dumpster fire. I mean, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the congresswoman from Florida who is the head of the DNC, it is not fitting that the head of the Democratic Party is actively fighting against democracy, right? And that's what we found with these emails that were exposed this week, that she was, and the party to an extent, was working against the Sanders campaign, working against him in terms of fundraising and debate schedules. And more specifically, you know, there are these calls to get somebody to ask him about his religious beliefs when he was in Southern State, when he was in Kentucky earlier this year campaigning. This is within the party. We should note that Bernie Sanders hasn't, you know, been a Democrat for a long
time. Right.
He's a recent Democrat. But, I mean, both of these parties, I think what is on display with both of them, to kind of look at a slightly more broad snapshot across the last 2 weeks, are the deep fractures within both of these parties.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to some extent, a lot of people don't want to hear this, there are a lot of Republicans that go way to the right of Donald Trump, and there are a lot of Democrats or progressives or liberals, call them what you will, that are way to the left of Hillary Clinton. And it feels to me, and we can go down this foxhole if you want, or we can move on to something else, but it feels to me that the two-party system represents less and less of the will of the people. It doesn't do the job it once did because this country is changing so much, because this country is such a melting pot. It's so diverse across so many different measuring sticks and metrics. I don't think anything's going to change, but it doesn't work.
But how? But well, why not? You know, Jill Stein was the Green Party candidate for president, was at the DNC doing everything she could to get attention to peel off some mm-hmm. Bernie supporters, whatever. Mm-hmm. But a third-party candidate has never really made any noise. We've had a little bit, sometimes taking a little bit of votes from here or there. And the other question I would have is about history. I mean, you know, you think back to 68, you think back to, you know, back into the 20th century, there were third parties back then, the mm-hmm. Whigs, and when you get back farther
right,
than that.
Right,
I mean,
right.
there have always been some rumblings and there's been some party disunity. What really strikes me now is just how easy it is for people outside the mainstreams of their party to gain traction. And maybe that's because of media coverage, because of social media, because
right.
of other things. It's easier to get attention, but it's harder to hold that attention
right.
for any period of time.
Right. So some of that, I agree with everything you just said. I think some of that's based off of tradition and the establishment. I will try not to get too far into numbers, but I started wondering about how the demographics of the country has changed. One interesting thing that I stumbled across, maybe this speaks to the larger conversation, is looking at census stuff this week, totally gigging out and dweebing out over political stuff and numbers. In 1940, North Carolina had a Latino population of 0.0%. Today it's about 9%, so 900,000 people who are Latino living in this state, not the whole country, but just in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have 9% of the lawmakers of the General Assembly Latino. I mean, 9%
right.
of the state government. I mean, there's not proportional representation. Change happens incredibly slow.
Right.
I think part of the reason change happens incredibly slow is because we've had 44 presidents. 43 of them have been white men.
Right.
So
Well, how many women are in the legislature? Like, you know, women have had the right to vote for a century.
And, sure.
And women are
well,
not—
Women make up half the population.
Yeah, they're not equally represented in the legislature
Mm-mm.
by far.
It's woeful. It's pitiful. Right. I don't remember what your question was, but as we talk about Jill Stein and Gary Johnson and Mr. Garrett, I'm forgetting his first name, the Constitution Party candidate.
Right.
I mean, wouldn't it be fascinating to see a greater— representation, whether that's multiple parties, whether I think Utah is the only state that's likely, if any, to go against Trump and Clinton
mm-hmm.
Because of its Mormon population. And it appears like there's a chance that Gary Johnson could take that state. I don't know how it happens. I don't know if it ever would happen, but it would be refreshing to see some of these candidates, whether you're for them or really against them, wherever they fall for you, be more a part of the conversation. They're
right.
they're not. And I think with the lack of level of productivity of Congress right now, I don't think it's going to make anything any worse to have three or four parties represented.
Right. Yeah, know. It can't make it worse because the level of production certainly isn't there. Well, I want to get – we mentioned briefly
sure.
social media, and I want to get back to that. But first, earlier this week, Donald Trump made not one but two appearances in North Carolina. On Monday night in Winston-Salem, he was joined by Governor Pat McCrory and Senator Richard Burr, both running for re-election. And McCrory came out pumped up and ready to joke about HB2.
Exit this way and exits this way. And if any of you need to use the restrooms, and if you have any questions, go to the Philadelphia Convention where all the Democrats are.
So that's Pat McCrory Monday night in Winston-Salem. And what struck me about this joke was, A, wasn't all that funny, but also, you know, McCrory has sort of ridden this wave of HB2. He's been the face of it, for lack of a better term. He first sort of downplayed its impact. He said it was misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to get involved in sort of rolling certain aspects of it back. But now he seems like he has fully embraced this sort of position. If you think about it, like, and this isn't a great analogy, but it's the one that came to my mind just now. You know, President Obama, critics of President Obama, his health care plan, started labeling it Obamacare.
Right. You just go with it.
And then President Obama at some point said, you know what? That's a good name. Let's go with it. And he sort of took it over. This strikes me as a public moment where McCrory is owning HB2 and he's going to run on it to a certain extent. This is the first thing he said to a group of people,
right.
and the first time he campaigned with Trump.
Right.
I mean, he had to know that this was going
right.
to be recognized, recorded, and replayed as we just did. What do you think of that? Why is McCrory suddenly turned on this and become the face of HB2?
is it a trial balloon? Are they testing that out? This out now, as
is
we mentioned.
Polling? Do they have internal polling?
Do they have
them?
Internal polling? And I'm not in the inner Mercury circle, so I don't know. Is this a 3-month balloon bubble test where they say, all right, we have enough time. We're going to go in a slightly new, go down a different path with this and see what the results are. Maybe. Maybe it is calculated. Maybe it'll have good results. Maybe they have time to go away from it. Maybe this is just him trying a new narrative, a new line, and it's not backed up with firm numbers. I really don't know. I think it could be a number of different things. But yeah, November 8th is going to be, to some extent, a referendum on House Bill 2. We've seen let me back up. That's what Republicans, to some extent, are banking on and hoping for. We've heard from some experts who say that House Bill 2 is not going to drastically change voter turnout. So as we talk about these visits and the HB2 component of it and, you know, judgeships and foreign policy and, you know, the shrill of Hillary's voice and the authenticity of Donald's hair, like, you wonder what is going to make the difference with this slice of voters who are largely undecided. I haven't heard anybody really pinpoint, really say, all right, this is what's going to do it.
If it was easy to pinpoint, somebody would have pinpointed it and it's all we'd be hearing about. But yeah, it strikes me that two things. One, Pat McCrory may or may not have strong feelings on HB2. I don't know. But this seemed like a political choice. This seemed like he had decided, okay, this is what the way it's going to happen, the way it's going to go, and it's going to be a campaign issue whether he thinks so or not. It was also interesting to me that as much as he and Attorney General Roy Cooper, running on the Democratic ticket for governor, disagree on everything, they can agree on one thing, and that's that East Carolina University should be in the Big 12.
Right.
Because they both put out statements this week that said they support East Carolina being in the Big 12. But that seems to be about it.
That seems to be about it. Where do you fall in Greenville, North Carolina, Pitt County, being part of Oklahoma, Texas, Texas Tech, Texas still in the Big 12?
It would be transformative for that university, right? I mean, I don't think East Carolina people won't like to hear this, but, you know, it's a school that's overshadowed in major metropolitan areas of North Carolina by UNC Chapel Hill, Duke, and NC State, and Wake Forest,
sure.
I think, certainly out in Winston-Salem. So, you know, East Carolina people have great pride for the university. It is the University of Eastern North Carolina, 28,000 students.
Huge.
So it's bigger than some schools currently in the Big 12 and bigger than almost every school the Big 12 is considering other than East Carolina. Not a major metropolitan market, but
Neither's Norman, step. Oklahoma.
Yeah, it would be a giant step for East Carolina, and they're trying really hard to get it. And like I said, they've got the support of both gubernatorial candidates, and that won't matter at all in what the Big 12 decides.
Right.
But it'd be a great thing for the university. You can see why they want it so
bad. It'd be pretty interesting. And
yeah.
I think you could make an argument that ECU could become the biggest football power program in the state.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you've got Texas and
not anymore
Nebraska.
Into Greenville?
Right. If Oklahoma, you've got these big schools coming in to play games. That could be pretty interesting.
That's if Oklahoma is in Greenville that weekend, and in Chapel Hill, we've got
Syracuse.
I didn't want to go there.
Crappy football school.
If you go Boston College and you go, you know, I mean, I'm not hitting on those schools, but come on. I mean, that's a big deal. And that would draw a lot of attention. Now, back to politics.
Right. So,
unless you've got something to add about that.
I do. I want to, I guess, touch briefly on this, and this might roll us into the next topic. I think what history has shown us in terms of poll numbers and how they fluctuate and these conventions is that after a convention, even if it doesn't go that well in the Republican convention, and we'll put Ted Cruz at the top of the list as to reasons as to why it didn't go all that well last week, it wasn't the best Republican convention they've had, but it still did well for candidate Trump afterward in the aftermath in terms of poll numbers. So history indicates that the conventions give you a boost of several points. And what did we see on Monday? We saw Donald Trump come out ahead in some polls or even with Hillary in some polls. I think he was ahead in every poll I saw. What we're expecting is that the polls that come out next week are going to put Hillary back in front of Donald Trump. This is the seesaw game of polls that conventions have served as an indicator for decades. So I think as we think about HB2 and we think about when McCrory is going to appear with Donald Trump and when Cooper and perhaps some other down ballot Democrats are going to appear with Clinton, I think we're going to see it in the next couple of weeks, and then perhaps they'll get away from it a little bit. But I think that you know, there's an ebb and a flow to this thing,
right?
In terms of when we see people together, and time will tell. We'll see whether or not there is a similar kind of ebb and flow when candidates are joking about HB2 or
right.
hammering HB2, or if that just becomes a consistent for the next 3 months.
Right.
I mean, it hasn't gone away since the end of March, so it might not go anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that strikes me about these conventions and sort of coming out of them and the polls and all that stuff is, and who is going to make the decision, these moderate voters in the middle. There are rabid Donald Trump fans. There are rabid Hillary Clinton fans. Those minds aren't getting changed. The
yeah.
people who might get changed are the people who are going to decide one question. And that, I think that question is, who do I dislike less?
Right. That's what it's about. It's not about like.
It's not about like. Yeah. People aren't going to say, I suddenly wake up and go, you know, that Donald Trump, what are you saying really? Or that Hillary Clinton,
right.
I really think she, it's
right.
not going to be that. It's
right.
going to be, who of these can I see as president
right.
and who am I going to dislike a little bit less? And that those are the group of people who are going to decide that election. What's interesting to me is, does that carry over to the Senate races? And does it,
right.
in this state, Senate race in the state and the gubernatorial race in this state? I think that will be interesting to see. One of the ways in which, of course, we see all this love and hate for different candidates is on social media. Last night I was watching the Democratic National Convention. Tim Kaine was speaking. Now, I was trying to stay awake. It was not easy because his speech wasn't electrifying, at least from my perspective. I think John Oliver called him America's stepdad, and I think that seems pretty accurate. But anyway, I was, as many people do, following along on Twitter on my phone. And I see a tweet come across from North Carolina Republican Party that says, I'll read it exactly as it said. I've written down right here. Tim Kaine wears a Honduras flag pin on his jacket, but no American flag pound shameful or hashtag shameful. Now, turns out, though, the pin wasn't a Honduras flag. It was a Marine Blue Star Families pin for his son who deployed, who's a Marine, this week. Now, that's a gaffe. That's a fairly significant gaffe. The NCGOP deleted the tweet once it was pointed out to them. I think a TV reporter in New York said, that's not what that is. This is what it is.
Right.
Now, what's interesting, you see this happen in the North Carolina GOP getting involved, sort of back to what we're talking about, that diffused notion of these parties. This wasn't a Trump campaign sending it out. It wasn't any of that. It was a North Carolina Republican Party sent mm-hmm. this out. And I wonder, do these kinds of mistakes, or these kinds of statements, we saw Trump make some statements about, you know, Russia hacking Hillary's email.
Right.
We hear, you know, Democrats make statements that are highly controversial and problematic on their end. Do they matter at all? Do these kind of social media things matter? And you really have two campaigns, don't you? You have the real campaign getting on the ground, doing all this. But what the Trump campaign is showing is they're running a social media campaign.
Right.
They're not. It's a whole different strategy. How does social media play into all this?
Right. And that's all about emotion, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think facts, by and large, matter. Facts are important to us as journalists, as reporters, and I, you know, facts are going to come into play, but are facts what are going to decide this election and how you feel about the pin issue, or does it devolve into, you know, liberal media getting involved in criticizing the NCGOP? I mean, that you can quickly go down a hole that has nothing to do with the issue,
and then
at hand.
It all just becomes so much noise, right? And
yeah.
people tune that out,
right?
And they forget what the fact was we were
right.
even arguing about,
right? And to me, and maybe this just speaks more to, I don't know, what we do, which is we try to figure out what's right and what's not. And when we disseminate information, we've gone through some channel, some editorial process to, you know, understand what it is we're saying, or you know, work through who are we talking to and what are we going to, you know, ask them and what expertise are we going to try to get out of them. It's like it's just child. Oh, there's a pin, and it must be from Honduras. And now we're gonna send out a nasty tweet. What's wrong with Honduras? Like what? Like you can't take 20 seconds to ask. Senator Tim Kaine has a staff, right?
Like
you can't take 20 seconds to find, hey, what's the deal with that? What's the deal with that pin right there?
Right, right.
I mean, it's lazy, but
yeah.
it also speaks to the instant nature of social media, needing to make a pop, needing to make a quip, a remark,
right.
whatever.
Right.
I mean, this
own
is a
moment.
Waste of time.
You try to own the moment.
This conversation we're having is a waste of time.
That's right.
But
we just gave 100 times more consideration to it than the person, whoever it was, who sent the tweet. And that, you know, as you said, drives us as journalists a little crazy.
Yeah.
But I think it also drives a good chunk of the population crazy and voters.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that then becomes sort of lost in a big morass of, oh, these are both terrible candidates. All these campaigns are terrible. And it becomes, and it's not unfair, but it's too bad. Because what happens is, I was doing some back of the envelope math recently, and I figured out somewhere north of 3 million eligible adults in the state of North Carolina did not vote in 2012. Mm-hmm. That's 3 million people. That's almost a third of North Carolinians not voting. Right.
You said in what year? I'm sorry.
2012.
Okay.
I mean, to me, it's never been high. We've never seen, I think more people voted in 2012 than I could get this wrong, but
I think we had about 70% national.
It wasn't an outlier that was the number.
Right.
I think there are times that we've had lower vote totals and times we've had higher.
Yes.
But to me, that's an issue. Who's not voting in this and why aren't they voting?
Right.
I find that topic pretty interesting. And we're going to explore a little bit of that here at WNC, and I find it pretty interesting. But it is, I think part of the reason is all of this just people can't.
Well, it's become a reality show,
it
right? I mean, it's become a reality show, and who do you dislike more? Who do you want to vote off the island? Who do you want to, be center stage when the balloons fall? This is about so
not
much more than
interview.
That. Right.
It's what you just described.
And this is to be the leader of the free world. It's an incredibly complicated job that I think well-informed people, including us, only understand bits and pieces of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is so complicated. And it has not been the conversation about policy and, we touched on a moment ago to an extent, how this race is going to affect the U.S. Senate and how that could affect the balance of power and what our Supreme Court's going to look like over the next 25 or 30 years. And then the appellate courts and, what kind of legislation is going to, have a chance of surviving and moving forward in the next few years. And also all of these Obama has signed a couple hundred executive orders. If Hillary's elected, those largely are going to stay in place. If Donald's elected, those are coming off the books by Valentine's Day.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a lot of policy. There's a lot of influential stuff. We're much more worried about, pantsuits and sarcastic remarks. It's too bad.
It is too bad. And it is interesting, too, that, if voters tune it out, the thing that always drives me crazy is people say, it doesn't matter who gets elected. It's all the same. And you've been in the legislature. You've seen it at the state level. Following at the national and everything else, that's just not true. It does matter. It does matter for regular people, whether you vote or not. It is going to matter for all the reasons you stated about judges and about all these and how the direction of the country does go and whether we get into wars, whether all of those things do matter. And it's really easy, I think, for people to go, I just ignore it. It doesn't matter.
Right.
And then they go on about their day, not realizing, of course, that it does matter.
And there's a not to get too far into semantics here. There's a line in an Avett Brothers song where they say something to the effect of, your life doesn't change by the man who's elected. And, I'll concede that. I mean, my life, by and large, is not going to change drastically in the next 6 months because of who is elected. But there is incredible influence that is yielded by the folks that are in the White House.
Right.
I mean, as you just mentioned, for a number of reasons. And this isn't to say, you're not going to be homeless and out of a job because of who's elected president. But it's as influential as any other position, probably more so than any other job in this country.
Right. All right. Well, that'll do it for the Politics Podcast this week. Jeff, thanks for being on.
All right. Anytime.
Make sure to subscribe to the WUNC Politics Podcast on iTunes and Google Play and follow all the WUNC Politics stories on air and online. See you next week.